The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. As usual, I'll be your host for the next hour, Kingsley Kipuri. I'm joined in studio by Greg, who's now rejoicing that the Bucks made a comeback. Greg, welcome to the show.
As an Australian, it makes me really, really excited.
It warms your heart. Not to mention Trevor Noah's debut last night, which I heard went really, really well.
I wasn't there, but you know, I also heard it went well.
So lots of things you're just like excited about from a distance.
That's right. That's right. I'm particularly excited about today's show.
There we go. We've got a really, really packed one lined up, talking about all things local and international. Firstly, we want to start talking a bit about race relations in America. And I think one moment that really ignited this conversation, not only there, but even all the way over here, was the shooting and killing of Mike Brown in August 2014. This was an unarmed 18-year-old who was shot and killed by a police officer in Ferguson. And that's really a moment that I think all over the world that people will remember by asking, you know, how does this happen? What kind of system and what kind of situation causes something so tragic to happen? So we'll be talking to somebody who was actually involved in the case after that and lives close to Ferguson and can really give us a first-hand account of what's going on. Professor Justin Hansford, welcome to the show.
Thanks, glad to be here.
Good, good. Tell me, how's your time in South Africa going so far?
So far, so good. Yeah. I can't complain. The weather's great. South Africans have been really welcoming. Had a chance to go on the color run, so I was able to go out there and have a good time. So no complaints here so far.
Okay, perfect. Now, I think the first thing that I wanted to just talk to you about when I found out that we were able to meet with you and talk to you was really to get an idea of what it's actually like on the ground. I think we see things on Twitter and we see it on CNN, and it's often when there's a protest, or especially a violent protest, or unfortunately maybe somebody's just been killed, and it's always at these very heated times. So I'd love to get an idea from you of living close to Ferguson, like what it's actually like on a, you know, everyday basis.
Yeah, well, it's real life. People are living their daily lives. But one thing about Ferguson that I think is different from most places in the country is we had the situation last August, which was a transformative situation for people throughout the community. So I was out there with many other people when they shot tear gas, when the police would come and point guns at us and threaten to kill us. Just for protesting, right? And so as a result of that activity, a lot of people in Ferguson, young people who are activists, are fearless. There's nearly nothing else they can do to us that can make us intimidated. So as a result, when they are upset about race relations and when they see injustice happening, it's nothing to go and shut it down, you know, to go to a mall or go to a protest. Is a way of life in Ferguson in a way that it isn't in other places in the country, which also may have that same sort of Black Lives Matter revolutionary feeling in their hearts, but haven't had the same sort of situation where almost bathed in this or baptized, if you will, in this environment where you've seen the worst that they can do to you and you've survived it. And so now it's all downhill. So that's pretty much what Ferguson is like. It's a unique place with unique people.
I mean, I'm curious around, you know, what informs your actions now, because you've mentioned you've been on the front lines. You're in there when the tear gas is flying and people can't breathe and can't see properly. So I'm curious around sort of what preceded this, what preceded the really great legal career and really sort of decorated legal career and activism. What sort of informed? What informed this? Was you growing up, was civil rights and civil justice and racial justice, was that something that was really prevalent in your home or your upbringing?
When I was a kid, I wanted to be Michael Jordan, and I thought I was going to go to the NBA.
So. I saw your sneakers, man. Yeah, You're not far from it.
I still wear Nikes, you know. Of course, that didn't work out. I wasn't able to get over 6 feet in terms of my height, so that was the end of that. But I did, when I was about 14 or 15, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and that really changed my entire outlook, because it was a book that showed that I could use my mind as opposed to just my body, and as opposed to just my athletic ability, and really create change and be a positive impact on the community. I was a kid who was in trouble. I was actually home suspended from school, for about a week. I was in big trouble, and I picked up the book, and I read the book straight. I didn't stop to do anything else. I just ate and slept and read the book for about 3 or 4 days, and I really transformed into someone who was passionate about knowledge and using that knowledge in sort of a fight for civil rights when I was about 15 or 16. And people like Marcus Garvey, Nelson Mandela went on to become my heroes. Mm. And so since I was a teenager, I've been interested in the struggle. And then fast forward 10 or 15 years, and I find myself in Ferguson right when things pop off. So it sort of just was something that was supposed to happen, I guess, just like that.
Mm. Could you tell us just about how you found out about the Mike Brown shooting? If I'm not wrong, you were at a conference, I think, and how you found out and how you got involved?
I was actually in Washington, D.C. at the U.S.-Africa conference. Okay. So Africa was already present there. And I looked on my Facebook timeline, and I saw his dead body there. And I saw everybody was talking about it back home. And I was already scheduled to drive home the next day. Mm. And I ended up driving with a friend of mine from Chicago who was also an activist. And the whole entire drive, we're getting calls from activists, we're getting calls from people telling us what the situation was like. He was friends with Emmett Till's mother, so I actually was there getting calls from her. And so the whole entire trip from D.C. Mm. to St. Louis, about 15-hour trip, we're getting filled in on the situation. And then when I get there, I see some friends of mine who are out protesting. So I join them, and it was a unique situation. So you have thousands of people on the street. You know, you drive down the street, you'll see little kids, 5, 6 years old, coming up to your car saying, "Hands up, don't shoot." And you know, it was something that really just engulfed the entire community. I tell people that the thing about Mike Brown's last moments, which are, they're so powerful. So the last act he ever did was put his hands up in the air and say, you know, according to some observers, to say, "Hands up, don't shoot." And I tell people, if you had gotten a consultant and done a marketing campaign, you couldn't come up with a better slogan or a better way to communicate than his final moments, because little kids could just put up their hands and say, "Hands up, don't shoot," and they could identify with the movement. It's a gesture. You know, many people think the gesture is a gesture of giving up or a defensive gesture. But when you're out there on the streets protesting and police have their guns pointed at you, when you say "Hands up, don't shoot," and you put your hands up, they can't say you're reaching for a weapon. It's very clear that they're on the offensive and you're on the defensive. So with that gesture, you can walk right up to the police and protest right there. And, you know, they are put on the defensive because they can't say that you're a threat to them anymore. So it's there's strategic values to that gesture. It's a very spiritual thing. His last moments on earth created this gesture and this movement. So it's just such a powerful scene. I couldn't tell you in just a few minutes how powerful that scene was. And so that's what I saw when I arrived, which was August 10th. And so as soon as I arrived, I went straight out there to West Florissant, is the name of the street where most of the protests were taking place. Mm. And the rest is history.
I mean, I'm hearing very much your sort of activist mind, your protest thinking.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about the legal side of what you have sort of identified as what needed to happen next and how you actually got involved with the legalities of it all.
Well, yeah, I'm a law professor and I'm a lawyer. So, of course, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So, you know, I immediately started to think about some of the legal ramifications. Mm. I happened to be teaching a class on race and the law at the same time this happened. So it's pretty easy to teach class that semester. We just came and talked about what happened the previous week. And I'm currently working on a textbook on race and the law. So I've got a lot of background in the area of race relations and criminal justice and all of these issues that played right into the case. So it sort of was a perfect fit.
sort of closure of that and the collective outrage of people feeling that maybe there is no justice for black people in America.
Yeah, well, so that decision, as you may or may not know, was made by the county prosecutor. I hate to even use his name. His name's sort of like a bad word. Yeah, it tastes bad in my mouth. Yeah. His name is Robert McCullough, but he's someone who there's a lot of antagonism against in the black community. Not just really before this happened.
Okay.
And so the process itself was a one-sided process. Okay. And so, for example, Darren Wilson got to present testimony for 4 hours and tell his side of the story. Of course, Mike Brown never got to tell his side. But not only did he not get a chance to tell his side, he didn't get a chance to have his own lawyers question Darren Wilson. And the prosecutor, what he did was, you know, he gave Darren Wilson softball questions, and all of the witnesses who supported Mike Brown's story, they aggressively questioned them and undermined their stories. So, you know, so I can go into the details of the legal process, but many of us feel like that's another part of the system that's broken. Mm-hmm. So systematically, you see prosecutors who are good friends with cops. Don't forget, prosecutors prosecute criminals every day. And so they need to work with cops every day, right? So every day they're building these relationships with police, and then when police commit crimes, they're then asked to go and prosecute those same buddies of theirs that they've been working with all this time. And it's so the system is rigged, and we all know it. And unfortunately, in this case, we predicted the outcome. We knew what the outcome was going to be. That's why we kept protesting all that time.
Absolutely. And and something you and I spoke about just briefly before the show is there was a push to take this matter and these issues to the UN, and that's not something that we've heard too much about. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, no, we went to the UN, and I guess if I hadn't been there myself, I wouldn't believe it, because you don't hear about it too
Ferguson
much in the media.
To Geneva.
Yeah, you don't hear about it in the media too much, but Mike Brown's mother and father both went with us, as well as some of the activists who were leaders on the ground in Ferguson. You know, it was a powerful scene, you know. I can recall in particular one moment when Mike Brown's mother went and presented her own testimony, and she described what it was like to stand there in the hot sun for 4 hours. Her son's body's laying on the street. They won't bring an ambulance to come and try to provide any medical attention. And they won't let her even go to the body. So she stood there literally 4 hours in the hot sun in August with her son's dead body right there, nobody helping. And when she finished telling her story to the UN body, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. So people who were representatives from all over the world were able to empathize with her situation. And actually, the conclusion of the UN was that this entire situation is a violation of the human rights and the human dignity of African Americans. And so they agreed with her. They told her that this was wrong. And it's a shame she had to go all the way to Geneva, Switzerland
for somebody to
listen to her, right? And to get her dignity reclaimed, because that's what it was about, reclaiming her dignity and the family's sense of justice. But I think that this happened during that trip. And it was an important trip. And ever since then, you've seen the UN come out more and more to discuss the issue of police violence in the United States and how unjust it is. And even recently, the U.S. had to admit that they need to make changes on the question of police brutality and racial profiling. So, you know, I think it's made some sort of positive impact. We also know that when this trip happened before the decision not to prosecute was made. And we know that when they were deciding how they were going to respond once the decision was made not to prosecute, the governor and others said that we don't want to have more negative attention or international attention like we had in the past. So they decided to not shoot first and ask questions later, and nobody was killed during the protests, you know. And so we hope that that had some sort of positive impact when we went to the United Nations.
I mean, just when you're describing, I mean, you know, a body laying in the hot sun for 4 hours and just sort of, you know, the lack of dignity. I mean, all I can think is what do you think needs to happen? People talking about body cameras, people talking about, is it police reform? Is it judicial reform? Is there any point in aiming for incremental reform, or do the systems actually just need to be rethought and rebuilt?
So, right. Well, so that's the key question, right? So is the system broken, or, as I would suggest, is the system working exactly as it was designed to in the first place? And if it's the second one, then no amount of body cameras, no amount of reforms are going to make a difference. I mean, so for example, if you were to ask during the height of apartheid, you know, what we need to do, we don't need to change government. Let's just get these nationalist police forces some body cams, and they'll treat you guys nicer, okay?
Because there's evidence of
right. There's evidence, right? So they'll be nicer to you guys. You know, that's a big problem, and it's not going to work. What they'll do, of course, is use the body cams against you. So what we've already seen is that they take some of the footage from the body cams and use it as evidence when they're trying to tag someone with a crime. So even a minor crime like jaywalking or something like that, in the past, they may just let you slide. Now they have you on camera, and they're going to prosecute you to the full extent of the law. And so some of the issues that might get closer to a solution are, for example, the reform of this thing called stop and frisk, where they single out people that they think are likely to be criminals, and they stop them and frisk them, even if they haven't broken the law. Those sorts of things have to stop. So those are some of the things that get closer to the answer. But at the end of the day, like I said, the concern is the system isn't broken. The system is working exactly how it's supposed to work. And so we have to rethink the whole entire basis of how race in America functions in the 21st century. And it's a big job that, you know, we're not really ready for it yet, but we're working towards it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, are you seeing, or do you feel there's the political will, though, to ask those tough questions that are maybe national politics? Do you think it's the will is there to really interrogate some of these systems and to look into what's going on?
Not at all, right? But the protesters are there, and they're really pushing for reform. And so we've seen that all the presidential candidates, from Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders, at least all the presidential candidates on the Democratic side, have had to come to us, the protesters, and ask questions. And that's something that's new. That hasn't happened since God knows when. So we're making some sort of progress in that we're demanding that people come to the table and talk to us.
I mean, that's great. You're making it such that there's no way to engage in national politics without talking to you.
Right. And also shut it down, you know. So sometimes you have to shut things down to get people to listen. And that's the value of protests, right? So I have a friend named DeRay, who's a protester in Ferguson. And he always says that oftentimes you don't need to have a lot of complicated theories or, you know, a lot of speeches. Just acknowledging reality is enough to make you radical, and that's enough to radicalize you once you acknowledge what's really happening. And so we're seeing that happen all across the country. And so people are being radicalized just by the simple fact of coming face to face with what is happening with race in America.
You were saying just quickly before the show, the truth is radical enough. Hey? Yep. You don't need to look too hard for it. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Professor Justin Hansford, who's in the country actually doing some research about Nelson Mandela, if I'm not wrong. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, one of my favorite authors, Toni Morrison, has this quote where she says that if there's a book out there that you want to read and it doesn't exist, then you have to be the one to go and write it. And so for me, as a young lawyer and an activist, I always wanted to know what it was like to be Nelson Mandela when he was my age, right? Because when he was my age, when he was in his early 30s, I don't want to date myself too much, but when he was in his early 30s, he was a lawyer and he was an activist at the same time, right? He was working for the ANC. He was practicing law with Mandela and Tambo, the law firm. And so I wanted to see what that experience was like and to see if there's anything we could learn from that experience that we could bring back to a place like Ferguson and help to make the social justice struggle that much more powerful. So it's really just me trying to go out and fulfill that dream and see if there's something that can be learned from it, you know?
I mean, are you seeing any parallels? Just as you, I suppose, put together your research report and some of the preliminary thinking, do you think there are any parallels between some of the stuff that's played out here and what you're seeing now on the ground?
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's a racial justice struggle versus a system that's designed to create white domination. So it's the exact same thing from a large overarching standpoint. Now, of course, the particulars of apartheid and what's happening now are different in the sense that it was enshrined in law at that time on the grounds of race. And what we have, it plays out not so much enshrined as what they call de jure segregation, which is using the law for segregation.
Yeah.
It's de facto. It's what's really happening on the ground every day. So, but for the, in a broad sense, we're doing the same thing. We're fighting a racial justice struggle. We're searching for everything that we can use to make change, leave no stone unturned. We're trying to go international. For example, I'm here, you know, just like the ANC and other movements went international and got their support abroad. We're trying to make sure that we're able to change the narrative around the inequality in the same way that the ANC was able to do that. So there are a lot of parallels. Mm. You know, I could go on and on about the parallels.
The system, though, that you're fighting against seems very resistant to change. I remember we've seen almost the conservatives in America and the American media take almost any chance they can to attack the Black Lives Matter movement and sort of bring it down, even when there's not even any, not justification, but any sort of link to what they're saying happened.
Right.
So it's definitely going to be a long struggle.
Right. Well, yeah. So I think that's the reality that we're going to have to face. So we live in a time where people want it now. You're used to being able to just pull it up on your phone, and you know the revolution won't be able to be not just televised. It won't be on your app or on Twitter. It's going to be a long-term struggle, and I think we're having to recognize that there's going to be opposition. So the conservatives in the media and in the presidential election are just one example of the opponents. The biggest opponent, of course, are the police unions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're fighting and using the harshest language that you can imagine. So our local police union has one of their chiefs. His name's Jeff Roida. He came to a rally a couple of months ago with a wristband on saying, "I am Darren Wilson." And so, you know, they still celebrate Darren Wilson on the 1 year anniversary of Mike Brown's killing. One of the policing organizations in the St. Louis region announced that it was going to be Darren Wilson Day. So they're the same day Mike Brown was killed, 1 year later, they've announced that that day is going to be Darren Wilson Day in this policing organization's whatever dream world they live in. So these are the sorts of opposition factions that we're seeing even today in 2015 on a local level, let alone a national level. So I don't think we can really think that a few body cams or you know, a few small reforms are going to be enough to make that long-term change happen. You know, we're going to have to change attitudes and hearts and minds and policies and laws at the same time.
I mean, I hear you. I found a quote that you had somewhere that I just loved, and you were saying on blackness, it's a gift and a curse.
Mm.
Biggest underdogs in the world, but at the same time have this tremendous opportunity to make a real change.
Yeah, you know it. Yeah.
So it sounds like despite the tragedies happening, that it's also somewhat an exciting time and a chance to, you know, be part of something really tremendous.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, when I came here, I heard about Roads Must Fall and Transform.
Open Stellenbosch
and Transformation.
Transform Vits.
There's really a global movement happening, and it's based with young people and the students, and it's exciting. And you know, you've got musicians signing on. Janelle Monáe made a song. We play Kendrick Lamar's song all the time at our protest now. So, you know, you've got all parts of the movement coming together. So it's going to be an exciting thing that's going to take place.
Absolutely. And it's really credit to people like you who, you know, who are leading the way.
Yeah, man. I'm just glad I was there at the right place at the right time, you know.
Okay. Professor, thank you so much for making time for us.
Okay.
And thank you for the great work you're doing, man. You know, you inspire our movements here and vice versa. So it's a big, big thank you.
Thanks, man. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we look forward to reading your research. I can't wait to see what you come up
with. All right, cool, cool.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
All right, take care.
So Daily Mavic Show on Cliff Central. We're just going to go into a quick break, and then we'll be talking about the corruption march that's happening tomorrow.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.